This week's Shedra Kiseitse starts with a law that has to do with war. Kiseitse lemilchom aloivecho, you go out to war against your enemy. And the Arizal says that even though this is obviously talking about a real live war, but it also hints to the most real live war that we experience in life, which is the battle with our Yetzer Hara. As the Mesil Shishorim brings down, and others, that there was a soldier that came back from battle, and a wise man told him, now you're going into the main battle, coming back to real life and having to fight your Yetzer Hara. So there's a hint in Kiseitse lemilchom aloivecha to the war with the Yetzer Hara. There's only one problem with that, and that is that there are two kinds of wars. There's a milchemes mitzvah, a war that is mandatory, you're obligated to do, the war against the seven nations, of conquering them and destroying them, and in that war there are no captives. You have to kill men, women, and children. Seven nations. The only time you can take a captive is in a voluntary war. You didn't have to do this war. You chose to go and make a war. Then you can take captives. So since this parasha is talking about taking a captive, it has to be talking about a voluntary war. So how could the Arizal say that there's a hint here to the war with the Yetzer Hara, when it would seem to me that the war against the Yetzer Hara is a mandatory war, not a voluntary war? First question. Second question. Okay, now we have the war, and you take a captive, a man takes a captive woman that he is enthralled with on the battlefield. She's not Jewish. And the Torah says that Torah understood that since the person is overcome by passion, that it'd be very hard for him to control himself. So the Torah gave a way to eventually be able to live with this woman, and therefore to push off the Yetzer Hara, right, until you go through this whole process. Because that which a person knows, he'll never be allowed to do in a permissible way. So then there's more chance he's going to do it in a prohibited way. But if he knows that if he waits and has patience, he'll be able to fulfill his desires in a permissible way, then he'll wait. And it could be that then, once he waits, he'll change his mind and forget about the whole thing altogether. So the Torah gives a whole process of how to take this woman home, and according to at least some opinions, not live with her at all until then, and go through this whole process of converting her. Okay, now if she wants to convert L'shem Shamayim on her own, then she can do it right away. That's not the problem. If she doesn't want to convert on her own to begin with, so then she goes through this whole process. If at the end of the process she decides that she will convert, then you can convert her and marry her. If in the end of the process she still doesn't want to convert, you have to make sure that she'll keep seven mitzvahs of Noach and not be an idolater. You can't live with her. You send her away, and that's the end. That's the parsha of Eishes Yifas Tovar. Now, the rabbis say, Lo Dibra Torah Ela Keneged Yetzer Hara. This whole parsha is just said in order to deal with the Yetzer Hara over here, because it's a wartime. Right, it's in the passion of war, the passion of this man has for this woman. The Torah knew that a person would not be able to control himself. So the Torah gave a way to deal with this Yetzer Hara, because the Torah knew that if it prohibited it, the person would just do something that's prohibited. He wouldn't be able to control himself. It's interesting that Rabbi Cheskel of Ramsky, I think more specifically his wife, said that we learn from here that if the Torah prohibited something, then you can do it. It's humanly possible to do. Because where it's not humanly possible to do, the Torah permitted it. Because the Torah knows, God knows what our psyche is, And if he knew that it would be impossible to deal with the Yetzer Hara, he'd permit it. He wouldn't prohibit it. So if something's prohibited, it means that we can handle it. In any case, let's get back to the main thing over here. So the rabbis comment on this idea of Lo Dibra Torah Ela Keneged Yetzer Hara the following. Better to eat rotten meat that's kosher than rotten meat that's not kosher. In other words, if you can eat rotten meat anyway, it might as well be kosher. Why have two sins? Why have two problems? Okay, this thing, taking this woman and putting her through this process and even eventually marrying her where she didn't really want to convert L'shem Shamayim to begin with, is rotten meat. But might as well do it in a kosher way than in a non-kosher way. Now the obvious question is, if God permitted it, why is it called rotten meat? And if it's rotten meat, then why is it permitted? Either way. Either it's okay. If it's okay, then it's not rotten. Or it's not okay, then it's not kosher. Why could it be kosher, but it's still considered rotten? What's rotten about it? Is it mutter? Is not mutter? If the Torah permitted it, then it's not rotten anymore. So how do you have this dichotomy where on the one hand, it's not good, but it's permitted? What does that mean? So there are other ways of explaining it. I'm going to tell you what I think. And one last thing that we're going to put into this cholent. Hey, we have one question. The whole war, right, is a hint to the war with the Yetzer Hara, yet it's a voluntary war, not a mandatory war. Second question is, the Torah permits this woman, right, under the circumstances, because the Torah knew that you couldn't control your Yetzer Hara, so you will go through this process better than nothing, and it compares this to eating rotten meat that's kosher rather than rotten meat that's not kosher. Why is it rotten? If it's kosher, then it should be okay. What's not good about it? If it's permitted. The only thing that would make it not good is that it's prohibited. It's not prohibited. So what's not good about it? And thirdly, it says that the process is you bring this woman home and you shave her head. And you either cut her fingernails or let her fingernails grow. It's a machlokas in the Gemara. It's an argument in the Gemara. Which one? And you make her remove her beautiful, attractive dress that the goyim used to wear during war to attract the enemy soldiers, and make her wear a plain dress, and she sits in your house for 30 days and cries for her mother and father, and according to the Gemara, not only her physical mother and father, she cries over her old religion for 30 days. Says the Zohar Chodosh, there's a hint in the crying of this woman for 30 days to the month of Elul. The crying of this woman for 30 days hints to the month of Elul. Somehow there's a connection between letting this captive woman cry for her mother, father, and her old religion for 30 days somehow connects to what we are supposed to be doing during Elul. What's the connection? So in order to answer all of these ideas, I want to say the following. The concept of this non-Jewish woman who you capture in war and you take her home and in the end is a Shiloh whether you're going to convert her and marry her or whatever, has the following allegorical connection. Okay, we live in a world where there are a lot of things that are not necessarily on the surface things that are mitzvahs. They're not averas either. Okay, sometimes you can take something that is parav and turn it into a mitzvah. You can make it good, right? You can take something that's not a mitzvah or an avera and make it into a mitzvah, make it into avera. Eating kosher food, okay? You can eat it l'shem mitzvah, sudas mitzvah, to celebrate a mitzvah, and it becomes a mitzvah. Or you can eat it like a glutton and it becomes an avera, even though it's 100% glatt kosher. Right, so permissible things can be transformed into mitzvahs or can be used and be averus. Okay. Here you have this woman it's possible that you'll be able to convert her, and she'll convert l'shem shamayim. And it says that there were neshamas lost amongst the nations of the world, and that's one of the reasons we go into galus and come into contact with these people, in order to attract the Jewish neshama, should attract like a magnet these holy neshamas that are lost, the sparks lost amongst the nations of the world, and bring them back to their source. Every convert who converts, the Svarim say, originally had a potential to be Jewish. There's something about that neshama that has a spark of Judaism in it. And that's why it says that sometimes converts lead a difficult life, because they waited too long to awaken to that spark. Right? Nobody says a non-Jew has to convert. But there's something that's there, that's potentially there from the beginning, so maybe they waited too long. That the whole concept only applies if there's something potentially there to begin with. So, could be that this woman will be another Rus. Mashiach is going to come from her. Right? She was also a convert. So converts are pretty special. So, could be that she's not from that stock. Okay, she'll convert and she'll be okay. She'll be a good wife. Or it could be she's not going to convert at all. She'll remain a goy and you have no business living with this person. And you have to send her away. Anything's possible. But the idea is that there are things in this world that on the surface are not necessarily mitzvahs, that could be transformed into mitzvahs, that could be really good things to do, or bad things to do. You have to be able to function with them and deal with them and transform them and sublimate them into mitzvahs. Okay? Those are called divrei rishus. Those are things that are not mandatory, they're not mitzvahs. Eat matzah, right? Don't eat on Yom Kippur. Those are mandatory things. They're things that aren't mandatory. They're divrei rishus. They could be used for good. They could be used for the bad. Right? Depends how you deal with them. So this parsha of the war with the Yetzer Hara is that kind of war with the Yetzer Hara that's not over mandatory things. It's not over treif or matzah. It's over plain, ordinary, glatt kosher pizza. There's no mitzvah in the year to eat pizza. There's no prohibition to eat pizza. Okay? Pizza is something that you can use if you're using it in a very positive way and transform it into a mitzvah. Or if you do it in a negative way, you can transform it into a veira. Okay. That's called Nuchemes HaRishus. That's called the war that you have on permissible things. Not mandatory, not prohibited. The middle area. Okay, so we already answered one question. We're talking about a parsha where you're dealing with the things in life that are not mitzvahs or averas, but are the majority of what life is all about. Things that are not mitzvahs or averas, but things that you do on a regular basis, which you can transform into a mitzvah, or, Rachmana Lisan, transform into avera. So we already now understand now the background of this parsha. It's talking about Milchemes HaRishus. It's talking about the war that is not mandatory. It's a voluntary war. But we're talking about how you deal with things of Rishus, permissible things. Okay, first thing. Second thing is, when dealing with things of permissibility, things of Rishus, what's rotten? It's not osir. Torah said it's okay. You can eat pizza. Glatt kosher. Eat it. No problem. Okay, make a bracha, right, bench, you have to bench, whatever, you have to say bracha achrona, right, don't eat it on a fast day, you're within the limits of permissibility. What makes it rotten? What makes it rotten is that the reason I'm eating it is because I have a desire to eat it. What you do because you want to do it is rotten. Not awesome, but it's rotten. People should not function in this world based on taiva, on desire. Why are you doing it? Well, I like pizza and it tastes good and I desire it. That's not the way a Jew should live. Why eating this pizza? Because right now I'm hungry, right? This is a kosher thing to eat. I need to eat because I need to be able to serve the Rabbanu Shalom properly, right? I thought it out. This pizza right now for me is a great thing for me to do that will bolster my avodas Hashem. It's not a mitzvah. but I'm doing it because I thought it out, and emotionally, intellectually, it right now is the thing that I need to do in my larger avodas Hashem. That's how a person should function. Basically, the Mesillas Yesharim calls that zihirus. Before you do something, think, is this 100% okay? Am I doing it because I want to do it? Or am I doing it because it's not the right thing to do? At this moment, this is what I need, right? Because of my larger avodas Hashem and how I have to serve the Rebbe Shalom, right now I need a piece of pizza. Not I'm doing it because I'm drawn to it, because I desire it, and that's it. And I desire it, and there's nothing wrong with it, fine. No, just being drawn to something by desire, and that should be the deciding factor whether you do it or not, even if it's 100% okay. That in itself makes it rotten, because a person shouldn't function based and motivated by desire. That's the problem. So we answered the second question. So now we know what the background is. The background is we're talking about things that you do that are not prohibited and not mitzvahs, divrei rishus, but if you do them because you are reacting to a desire, that's rotten. May not be awesome, but it's rotten. You have to do things because you've analyzed them, you have investigated them intellectually and emotionally, and they're the right thing to do at the moment, whatever it may be. They're not a mitzvah, they're not an aveira, but for you they're the right thing to do because you've come to the conclusion intellectually, emotionally, on every level, that this is the right thing to do. That's the idea. Even something as simple as a piece of pizza. Okay, well, it's foreign to me too. Honest. Okay? But that's how a person has to function. Therefore, the Torah says, you want this woman. It could be she's going to be the next Ruth. Mashiach's going to come from her. It could be she's been waiting for this moment for her neshama to blossom. Could be that she's a Goya that you want to stay far away from. Could be she's not Rus, she's not a Goya, she'll convert, she'll be a nice wife. Could be. But if the reason you want her is because of desire, that's rotten. So don't give in to that. We're not going to let you take her from desire itself. You're going to have to push aside the desire and come to the conclusion whether this woman is taka for you or not. It's possible that she'll convert right away, because she's really L'shem Shemayim. You found this Rus HaMoaviyah, right, amongst the Goyim. Could be she's not like that. You're going to have to wait 30 days, go through this process. It could be at the end of the process, you're going to have to send her away. Whatever it is, but you're going to do it because of deliberation, because you've decided that this is the right thing to do, not because you're drawn to her by desire. That's the parsha. Hold on, you can ask questions again. How does that fit in with Elul? We have a lot of things during the year that we do that are not prohibited. They're not aveiros. They're not mitzvahs. And we've gotten used to doing them as part of our regular life, flow of life, because we like to do them. We enjoy them. And that is the motivation, because I like it. Because it's desirable to me. That makes it not treif, but rotten. And therefore, before you come to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and you can deal with mitzvahs and aveiras, mitzvahs you haven't done, aveiras that you've done, and do tshuva, first you have to settle all the things that are not mitzvahs and aveiras and decide whether they are or not. You've done all these things, and most of your life is not mitzvahs and aveiras. So, you've gotten used to doing them. And you've done them because you like doing them, because you desire to do them. Take a month and analyze. Are all those things kosher v'yosher? Are they rotten or are they downright awesome? But you're doing them because you enjoy doing them. Maybe that's not good enough motivation. Maybe you have to analyze and find out, are they the proper things to do? Are they not proper things to do? Are parts of them proper? Are parts not? Right? Can you deal with this as a mitzvah, as an aveira, as somewhere in between? before you come to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is for mitzvahs and averas. First you have to find out what's a mitzvah and what's avera. Most of our life is not mitzvahs and averas. It's the neutral area. But if the whole reason why you're doing those neutral things is because you have a desire to do it, then you better take 30 days and analyze those things and find out whether some of those things you're going to have to, what's it called, take into the new year as mitzvahs. They're really mitzvahs. You don't even know it. You're doing it because you desire it. Or they're really averas and you better do tshuva on them during Aseres Yemei Tshuva. Or they're taka somewhere in the middle, but the motivation to do them should not be because you desire them. It's because you've come to the conclusion that they're okay things to do. That's the month. And now, how does it work? So therefore, what's it called? You have to make this analysis. You have to come to this conclusion. You can't just be drawn to these things because of emotion, because of desire. You have to be able to look at them in a very objective way and come to the conclusion, are these the right things to be doing or not? Which category do they fit in? Are they things that I have to do tshuva on Seres Yemei Tshuva? Are they things that I should bring into the coming year because they're taka mitzvahs and can be done in a mitzvah way? Or are they things that taka are neutral, but I'm not doing them because I desire to do them. I'm doing them because I come to the conclusion that they're okay things to do. That in my context, these are things that I should be doing. They're not mitzvahs, but they're not averas, and they're, for me, they're positive. So what do you do? First thing is, bring the woman home. Okay? Meaning, take the things that you've done all year, because you like doing them, and you never really thought about them, and bring them into a framework where you can observe them and analyze them. Bring them into your domain where you can see them on a regular basis and see them from all sides and analyze them. So don't just look at the woman, what you saw from afar, on her turf. Bring it to your turf. Bring it into your home where you can analyze it. That's the purpose. Purpose of these 30 days of Elul is analysis. Analyze your life. Why are you functioning? What motivates you? What are you doing? Don't leave it just because, well, Bali, right? You know, I enjoy it. It's okay, and it doesn't seem to be trade. It says glatt kosher on it, so what could be wrong? But if the motivation is because I like it, because it appeals to me, that's not a good enough motivation. So first thing is, bring it into your framework, into your domain, so you can analyze it, first thing, and study it. Next thing, the Gilchas Rosha. A lot of things, now we're talking intellectually, a lot of things appeal to people, okay? Not because intellectually they're really the right things to do or good for you. Again, we're not talking about averas now, right? That piece of pizza, okay? Not necessarily because eating a piece of pizza is, yes, I need it because I have emotional needs and I have psychological needs and I have what's it called, whatever, and I need to eat that piece of pizza. I can't deprive myself of that. Sometimes you build castles in the air intellectually that edify things that intellectually are not really, don't hold any water. But you create fantasies and spin-offs of why these things are necessary for you. Okay, it's hard to explain when it comes to a piece of pizza, but there's many other things, right, that a person makes justifications for and all different kinds of philosophies that edify what, if you get down to the basics, is this thing good or bad, right? Is it intellectually defendable as a good thing to do? If you take away all the edifications, all the justifications, all the extra things, and you look at it as it is in what its essence is, you're going to see that you're fooling yourself. It's not really what you need. Okay? It's not really what you need. I'll give an example from myself looking back. When I lived in Miami, we looked for a house, and in Miami many houses have swimming pools. It's not an unusual thing because the weather, and especially from people, there's not too many separate beaches in Miami, if there are none. Right? There's not too many places where you can go swimming separate. So if you have your own swimming pool, not only can you go swimming separate yourself, you can even make it available to other people and do a mitzvah, whatever. So we convinced ourselves that we're going to get a house with a swimming pool for all these great reasons. Right? We're going to be, you know, mezakes harabim and ourselves and whatever. And it came to a point where even we figured that, you know, how could you really be a Oved Hashem if you don't have a swimming pool, because you're missing that peace of mind and the ability, and there's always that nesoyin to go where it's not permissible or whatever. And okay, and it becomes like almost an exercise in edification of something. It's okay, there's nothing wrong with having a swimming pool, but really, is that necessary or not? It becomes almost a necessity of life. Then we moved to Eretz Yisrael, and the house we had in the beginning was a three-bedroom house. We had Kenainahara, at the time, 8 children in 2 rooms, and we didn't have any swimming pool, except in the winter when it leaked into our living room. And we discovered that, hey, you know what? You could really serve the Rabbanu Shalom and not have a swimming pool. So sometimes you can, you know, fool yourself and edify this thing, and if you just take away all the edification, is it right or wrong? It may be right, but take away all the wrappings. So that's the first thing. You're attracted to this woman, she has nice hair, whatever, that's the intellect. Get down to the basics. Take away all the nice additions, the beautiful hair that attracted you, okay? And the hair is also the strength of the body, like Shimshon, right? His hair was a strength. Don't reinforce, fortify these things with the nice hair and all these nice arguments, right? Cut away the facade and get down to the nitty-gritty. Is it right? Is it wrong? The thing itself, intellectually. Is it right hashkafa or wrong hashkafa? Take away all the edification. That's the first thing. Gilchas Rosha. That's talking, analyzing what you're doing from an intellectual way. But we don't only function intellectually, we function emotionally, actually also. Next thing comes to the fingernails. The fingernails are the extension of the hand. The hand is representation of action. What it's connected to. What do you do? What are you doing? So now we have to know physically, emotionally, is it a good thing or not? Intellectually, we now took away all the facade. We shaved the head of the thing that we're analyzing, that piece of pizza. We got rid of all the edification. Is eating a piece of pizza for you right thing or wrong thing? Forget about all the edifications. Now, how about lemaisa? So one way of saying is, same thing. Take away all the connection. Now you're going to say, well, you know, if I eat that pizza and I have a little bit more strength, I'll be able to do more mitzvahs and I'll be able to... The same thing with the pool, right? What's going to lead to, right? Not what are the arguments to want to say that it's the right thing to do. That's intellectually. What's it going to lead to, right? I'm going to be a happier person. I'm going to be a better person. I'm going to be whatever. It's going to lead me to positive things. So don't look at what it leads to, right? Because sometimes... If it leads to, and I'll be more successful like that or whatever, success is not one of God's names. Just because something's successful doesn't mean it's right. So don't necessarily look at what it's going to lead to. Cut the fingernails. Look at it for what it is, not what it leads to. Don't judge it on what it leads to. Or there's another possibility. Let the fingernails grow. Why? Because when it comes to actual mitzvahs, we have a rule. Mitzvah gereres mitzvah. Mitzvahs lead to mitzvahs. Averas lead to averas. So let's see what that pool, what that piece of pizza is going to lead to. Does it lead you to more mitzvahs? Does it lead you to other things? Does it lead you to time that you spend your time in that pool when you could be learning, could be giving tzedakah, whatever, or you're in the pool and people come for tzedakah. I'm sorry, I'm in my pool. I have no time to give you tzedakah or get involved with you or whatever, and I don't go to shiurim and I don't get involved with people and I don't have anything to do with my children because I'm laying in my pool all the time. So if it's a mitzvah, it should lead to other mitzvahs. It should give you a relaxation so you can go to Moshiach better. So what does it lead you to? So now let the fingernails grow. So there's two ways of looking at it. When it comes to what it leads to, not mitzvahs, but is it successful? Is it make me whatever? That may not be a way. Cut it down to what it really is. But then look and see what it leads to. Mitzvah averas, that is a reasonable thing. So one opinion says, cut the fingernails. The other one says, let the fingernails grow. See what the, what it leads to, or don't see what it leads to, based on the two ideas that we say. Then there's the third thing we do. Then we take off, by doing this, intellectually and emotionally, actually, we take off the facade, that beautiful, attractive dress that these things had that pulled you originally and gave you the motivation to do it because it was attractive, because it was desirable, and now you can make a emotional and intellectual decision, is it the right thing to do without that clothing pulling you, without that attractive clothing pulling you. That's what it means, what's it called? Ve'hesira simla shivya me'aleha. Then comes the final test. Let this woman cry for her mother and her father, meaning her physical mother and father, and let her cry for her idolatry. But there's different kinds of crying. Why is she crying for them? One possibility is she's crying for them because she feels still attached to them. And she feels lost without them. So she feels still attached to her mother and father, and she's crying for them because she wants them. She's crying for her old religion because she feels attached to it, and she's crying because she can't do it. That's terrible. Then you don't want this woman. This is a woman who's still attached to her goyish father and mother and to her religion. Or there's another kind of crying. She's crying because she realizes that's her past and she has to make closure. And she's coming to closure of accepting the fact that she's not going to have a connection anymore to her father and mother. She doesn't know if they're alive or what happened to them, whatever. She's crying over her severance of relations with them, but as closure, and she's crying over her religion as closure. That's fine. Not great, but it's already means that she's disconnected from them. Or there's another possibility. Ibn Ezra says she's crying for her father and mother that they didn't have the opportunity to convert and be Jewish also. That's already a different kind of crying. She's crying over Avodah Zorah. She's crying because she served the idolatry before and she feels terrible about it. That's already somebody special. So it's three kinds of crying. Now, take a look at those things. Take a look at that piece of pizza and that swimming pool, right? And see what connections it had, what it represented. Is it connected to something negative? Is it connected to something positive? Or it's somewhere in the middle, right? Give a chance for that thing, or for you, to cry over that thing for 30 days, what is the connection? What is that thing? You can't look at it in a vacuum. You have to look at it intellectually without all of the facade that you build around it. You have to look at it emotionally and actually, what does it lead to or whatever. But now, what is the thing itself? What's it connected to? Is it connected to good things? Mitzvahs? That piece of pizza can be put into the category of a mitzvah because of how you're using it? Can it be put in the category of averas, the way you're using it? Put in the category of parva things, the way you're using it. That's the idea of the crying. Now, look at this woman cry and distinguish between the different kinds of crying and then come to the decision where she's holding. Same thing. Look at the things that you've done during the year that you led to by desire. Okay, take away the desire. See it in its stark reality. Shave its head, cut its nails, see what it leads to, and now be able to distinguish the different kinds of crying that's heard from that thing. Crying that tells you it's really good, crying that tells you it's really bad, crying that tells you it's somewhere in the middle. That's the month of Elul. The month of Elul is that crying for 30 days, which means to be able to distinguish from the different kinds of cries that emanate from things that are permissible, but originally you were drawn to them by passion. Take away the passion and see what those things are crying about. Are they crying, attaching them to good? crying, attaching them to bad, crying, closure, neither good nor bad, parav, and now you can use them intellectually, emotionally in a positive way, without being drawn to them by passion. And now you'll be able to start a new year and know you now have distinguished most of your life. Again, it's not mitzvahs and averis. Most of your life is these permissible things. Till now, the whole year, you were pretty much involved with them because of passion, because of desire. Now you took that away. Now you're able to distinguish what do you have to do tshuva on from those things that you fooled yourself or whatever, and send them away. And that's what Aseres Yemei Tshuva. Aseres Yemei Tshuva is for mitzvahs and averis. The month of Elul is to distinguish between the most of the things that are not mitzvahs and averis, which of them are mitzvahs, which of them are averis, and which of them are pariv and should be functioned, but not rotten, but in a healthy way, not directed totally and solely by passion. That's the idea. So that's the connection again. So it answers all our questions. It answers why the war we're talking about is a voluntary war, because we're talking specifically about those areas of life that are not mitzvahs or averis, the voluntary things. Why is it rotten? Because you can't function totally on passion and desire. It has to be more intellectually honest, more emotionally honest, or whatever, right? And thirdly, what's the connection between this woman crying for 30 days in the month of Elul? That's exactly the whole idea of crying, is to give you a chance to analyze her crying. Is her crying put her on the mitzvah side? Crying put her on the avera side? Crying leave her somewhere in the middle? You have to be able to analyze the things in life by hearing their cry, what they're attached to, what they attach you to, right? And that way to decide during Aseres Yemei Tshuva which things to do tshuva on, which things to bring and strengthen, and which things to do as rishus, but how to do them properly, not just because you're drawn to them or whatever. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Yes.
Bring the actions into your domain. Like, practically, in our cases, would that be to, like, sit down and write down a list of
exactly
what the actions are.
The Mesillas Yesharim, when I wrote this drasha a few days ago, it was before I gave a shir on the Moshav. We're learning Mesillas Yesharim, and it happened to be that we're up to the mid of Zahirus, being careful. It's exactly, this drasha is exactly what it says over there in Mesillas Yesharim. Before you do something, analyze it, make sure what you're doing is right. That it's all right, that part, what part, whatever. Then, after you've already done things, then you have to make a cheshbon ha-nefesh, meaning sit down and look over the past and see the things that you've done and become accustomed to doing. Are they the right things to do? Or you're just assuming they're right? You like them and therefore they're okay? Right? Look and make a cheshbon ha-nefesh on a daily basis. Or here we're talking about at the end of the year for a month. Look back over your life, things that you're accustomed to, things that you do regularly, and you assume that they're okay. Are they okay? And look at them intellectually, without all the facade, right? Take away the attraction, and look at them emotionally, physically, like we said, right? What do they lead to? What do they lead you to, right? What? Don't judge them on what they lead to necessarily, right? But do they bring you to mitzvahs or averas or whatever? That's the second thing. Take away the attraction, and then hear the cry of those things to know where they are. And then you can decide, do I want to continue these things? Do I have to do tshuva for them? Should I strengthen them because they're good things to do? And that's what now Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is all about. But first you have to know from the majority of your life, which is not mitzvahs and averus, where to put them, where to compartmentalize them. You do that by having a month of bringing them into your domain and thinking about them. Cheshbon ha-nefesh.
I just want to ask if you could clarify the difference between a voluntary war and a mandatory war, and
yeah.
Does that apply today?
Yeah, a mandatory war is the simplest one, is the war that God said you have to wage against the seven nations, conquer them, take away their land, settle it, There we gave them a chance. Before we came into Eretz Yisrael, we sent them letters and we said, look, we are commanded to conquer this land. You can choose to leave, and we have no problem. Right? God gave us this land. He told us to conquer it. And one of the nations, the Girgashi, left, and they went to Africa. And God gave them a beautiful land. I think the Panavisharov said the Cape Town is as beautiful as Eretz Yisrael. It was given to them specially like that. The Girgashi. The ones that we told them, if you choose to stay, we're going to have to fight you. And we're going to have to conquer you. And we're going to kill men, women, and children. So you should be aware of that. So that was a mandatory war, and you don't take captives in that war. Another kind of mandatory war is where we are attacked and we're fighting a defensive war. There also, it's a mitzvah to defend yourself. There also, you don't take captives necessarily. A voluntary war is we're going outside of Eretz Yisrael to wage war against people who are whatever, idol worshippers or whatever, and there we don't have to kill them. We have to make sure that if we conquer them and take, either we don't have to take their land either. We now take a tributary from them. We take taxes from them, like anybody wages a war. And we make sure that the people there keep the seven mitzvahs of Noach. They don't have to be Jews, but we can't let them be idol worshippers. And they pay a tribute to the Jewish people and help our economy. And they then become part of our empire or whatever, helping us as Goyim to do what Klal Yisrael has to do spiritually to help us physically.
Have we ever done a war like that?
In the time of David HaMelech, yeah. The times of David HaMelech, yes. They went out and fought wars outside the borders of Eretz Yisrael for economic reasons, for whatever, and then made them part of the Jewish Empire. These are the non-Jewish part of the Jewish Empire.
Does any of this apply today?
Not really. The only one that applies today, because to really go out on a war like that, you need a Sanhedrin, you need a Kohen Gadol, you need a Urim V'Tumim. We don't have those things. So to fight permissible wars, we can't do it. What wars can we fight? We don't have the mitzvah of any more fighting. The seven nations don't exist anymore. So the wars that we have are basically defensive wars. If we're attacked, we have a mitzvah to defend ourselves. That kind of war exists today. That's a Mochemes Mitzvah of defense. And supposedly that's why it's called the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, because they don't supposedly fight except preemptive strikes of defense. That's also, we don't fight offensive wars, we fight defensive wars. Right? Which is, a Torah is a positive thing. It's not exactly what the Torah had in mind, the way we fight the wars or whatever. Right? Sometimes we're too squeamish or too nice, right? And we endanger our soldiers for the sake of the enemy, which is not proper. And sometimes we're not. We don't fight a war with the same kind of spiritual ideals that we should be having an army that's on a very high spiritual level. But in general idea. The wars that we fight today are defensive wars. And those are Milchamas Mitzvah. Okay.
Yes.
Sorry, what was the Tzaddikai?
The what?
The
crying?
Yes.
The third type? The third type. Third type is like this. This woman can be crying for her father and mother because she feels abandoned by them and she would love to be with them and she still has a connection, attachment to them. That means that the thing that you've done is attached to really not good things. Get rid of it. It's an aveira, really an aveira. Then there's a second time of crying, the opposite extreme. She's crying because she feels, wow, my parents could have had this opportunity to become Jewish, and they didn't have that opportunity. I'm crying for my parents' lost opportunity of being Jewish. I'm so enthralled with my new life that I feel bad for my parents they didn't have it. I'm crying for my idolatry because all those years I served idolatry, I really regret, and I'm crying for the fact that I served idolatry. That's the other extreme. Then there's the middle. She's crying, she misses her parents, but she realizes she has no more connection with them. So she's crying as closure to close off her old life and start her new life. She's not crying with this great euphoric thing that I'm so happy to be Jewish, I feel bad for my parents. I feel bad that I don't have a connection to my parents anymore, but I don't have a connection. The crying severs the connection. I don't really regret my life of idolatry, but it's over. And I'm crying to signify that it's closure. So that's not great positive. It's not great negative. It's somewhere in between. Okay, now you can start anew and use these things not because you desire them and have passion for them, but because they could be used in a positive way. That's the third type.